This is Bob Fetrakis with The Other Side of the News, brought to you by thefreepress.org. WCRS Community Radio 98.3 and 102.1. This is WCRS Community Radio 98.3, 102.1. Welcome to The Other Side of the News. And one of the people who's been making news on the other side, I'm not sure what side that is, Javi Wasserman.
Great to be here.
That is a good question, though.
Oh, I know it.
Which side are you on?
I'm on the side of the sign that Woody Guthrie said, you know, on the one side it said no trespassing, on the other side it didn't say nothing. That land was made for your name. I think he just turned 100, right?
He did. The 100th
anniversary.
And Pete Seeger is still with us. And
93, I think, Pete.
Did something for you, did he not?
He did. You should play it. The Soartopia song. Just dig it up off the web there, soartopia.org, with Dar Williams and David Burns. It's a great piece. Don't you know we're going to have a Soartopia? I walked into Pete's living room once. I've known Pete a long time. I had just written Soartopia and had one of those ridiculous requests. You know, I said, Pete, you think you could write a song for Soartopia? You know, and he said, why, sure. And he whipped out this guitar, and I mean banjo. And the banjo said, this machine surrounds hate and makes forces of the surrender. And he just, in 5 minutes, he whipped out a song. So then I was sitting there writing verses. He wanted me to write verses. And I'm sitting there writing, and I'm handing him these verses, and he's looking at me like, you know, I'm handing him bags of dog dung.
Finally, it wasn't exactly Bobby Zimmerman. Woody Guthrie.
That's what they sounded like, actually. And at the end, he says, well, you know, a song is not an editorial. So he wouldn't really sing the song for a long time. He did it once and he didn't like it. And then this friend of his, David Burns, not the Talking Heads guy, who has, he's with the New Weavers. He wrote some great verses, and Pete loved them. And then one day, they were making an album in Beacon, New York, with a bunch of kids. It was called Tomorrow's Children. And they had a kids' chorus, about eight, I don't know, six or seven or eight kids. We're about 10 or 11, 12 years old. And it was really cool, and I heard about it, and I said, well, why don't you do the Soartopia song, and we'll film it. So I came in to Beacon, and a friend of mine came down from Massachusetts, and Dar Williams came over, and they sang the song, and we filmed it, and it was perfect. And later I realized, God, we did this in one take. And Dar had never really sung the song, well, maybe once or twice, and David, and it just was perfect. And so we made this video, and it's called The Song for Soartopia, and then it was on the album, and the album won a Grammy. So I am technically a Grammy-winning songwriter. Isn't that wild? Anyway, yeah, well, so there you go. So play the song for Soartopia if you can. I'd love it.
So the we'll have to do that. Did you bring it in?
Well, it's on the web. You can just download it. I don't really have a CD, I don't think.
But now we'll see if we can dig that up in the high-tech
WCRS. The world of high-tech. It's there for the taking on
HarveyWasserman.com. Here's my Pete Seeger connection. I was awarded, I think I told you, the second annual Pete Seeger Endowed Veterans of the Spanish Civil War PhD Scholarship at Wayne State University.
Cool.
Pete came in and threw this huge concert in Detroit, and you know there's a lot of lefties in Detroit.
Yeah.
And he raised enough money to endow a scholarship given out by Wayne State, a committee which included a lot of the Civil War vets and
Spanish Civil
War. Yeah, the Spanish Civil War vets, and I ended up winning that. And of course, he was probably happy. What came out of that was the idea of democratic socialism in America and the decline of the socialism.
Wow, that great book you wrote that I wrote the introduction for, we haven't published yet.
But we should.
Yeah, so Bob, what the world needs really now is a book about socialism that you know you wrote and I introduced, and time to get it out here. So, you know, we have that leftist.
I'm feeling after the 2012 election.
Oh, my God.
It's got to be the next project up.
Two empty corporate suits running for the same White House, you know, and Mitt won't release his tax returns. I know why.
Why is that?
Because he's concealing all the income he made from growing pot.
Why do you want to put out something that positive about Romney? On this show, to say he's concealing pot money is not a negative.
I know.
Particularly when you get Obama, the feds raiding
right.
It's really dispensaries sick. In California.
Well, I think really what Obama, what Romney really needs is a marijuana enema. But, you know, there's different ways to take marijuana, right? You can eat it, you can smoke it, you can... make
well,
tea out
I
of it.
I only know that because of Elvis, who was founded the Dowden Suppository.
You mean the Bin Laden Suppository. So anyway, it's a miserable election. But getting back to Pete Seeger, I mean, so they gave you actual money to go to school on?
Yes, they did, to help me work on my dissertation and think really deep thoughts. But when you're working on your dissertation, it's like, whoa, I got some money. I go out and do a lot of activism and have fun. And mm-hmm. and then the money runs out, and it's like, man, I got to finish this quick.
Well, that's how Solartopia got written, because I got a grant to do from three of my buddies, Jerry Mander, Alvin Duskin, and Randy Hayes. We had a wonderful lunch in San Francisco. It's the only grant I've ever gotten, actually. And they wanted me to do a story on a report on the hydrogen economy that they could put out of Jerry's foundation. And so Jeremy Rifkin had just written a book called The Hydrogen Economy. Mm-hmm. And so I read the book, and I thought it was total nonsense. I'm not total, but it just wasn't. It doesn't compute. You can't have a hydrogen economy because hydrogen's not free fuel. You got to produce it. And there are all sorts of problems with hydrogen. So about a month in, I said, you know, this ain't happening, guys. But I spent the money. I already spent the money.
Yeah.
So I had to do something. So I came up with, why don't we just do a vision of a green powered Earth? And that's how Solartopia came about. So
publish it. Like the fact that you had Pete Seeger doing a song for you.
Well, that came later. Actually, this is the joys of self-publishing. People should understand this. I published this book myself, and the idea that I had for the book was it would be really small and you could stick it in your back pocket, like the little blue books from the socialist press of the 1910s and, you know, or turn of the century.
Sure.
Last century. And so, but then I couldn't get it that small. And so then I printed it like the smallest size they had, but that wouldn't fit in your pocket. And then when you go around...
you could get it in those large jeans that hang below the buttocks.
Gangsters. Stick them in your underwear. So I couldn't do that. And
a
then
large pair of boxers would hold Solartopia. Yeah.
And so then I couldn't... and then, you know, when you go around speaking, you want to get some money for your book. You can't sell a little book. I mean, it's got to have some oomph to it, and Solartopia is pretty short. So then I went the opposite direction.
But what about
direction.
The phone book you helped produce?
That had tons of documents in it. That was the stolen election, the Bible of the stolen election that we put out. So then I said, well, okay, I'm going to do the opposite, and especially for the geezer crowd, I'll print it 8.5 by 11, and then I'll have big type. And I can't tell you how many people said, oh, I really like Solartopia, especially the big type. You know, so like, really.
All the people that used to live with Harvey on the farm.
That's right, you know. So I published it myself, and then I ran into Bobby Kennedy. I spoke at the Riverkeepers conference in San Francisco, and that was so much fun. God, that was great. And the day before, I had a long walk with Bobby in the Marine headlands. And then I attended their banquet that night. And this the Riverkeepers, I mean, you think they're like going to be this really serious, you know, we're going to save the planet. These people are total pothead, you know, hard drinking, hard fighting.
Yeah, it's the same river they went down to in high school. That's why they're trying to keep it.
Right, hard dancing. It was so cool. And I got to say that I was sitting in this, it was like a barracks they had north of San Francisco in the Marine Headlands, beautiful place. And Bobby Kennedy got up and told three of the filthiest jokes I've ever heard in my life. I mean, just total raunch, completely did it in an Irish brogue. It was spectacular. I mean, it was something you really, a total piece of Americana. Because Bobby, who's a wonderful guy, looks like a cross between his uncle and his father. You know, and he's just, you know, an amazing presence. So that was a ton of fun. So the point is I had...
Even though it's not true, it sounds like he smoked a lot of pot because of the throat problem.
Yeah, well, whatever. You know, we won't go into that. But so then I had the second edition, the larger edition of Solartopia, and I gave him a copy, and I begged him to write an introduction. And he said, oh, man, I'm so busy. And then he read it on the airplane and liked it and wrote me an introduction. So then I made the third edition, and I put that in, and this is the joys of self-publishing. I couldn't have never done it with a publisher. I mean, a publisher would never do that, you know, because it's too expensive and blah, blah. But it cost me $80 to redo the thing at Lightning Source.
So it's in three different editions?
No, then a month later, I went to Pete. And that, you know, it was very shortly thereafter, and I gave him the book, and I asked him if he'd write the song. He wrote the song. So then I took the sheet music, and I put it in the fourth edition. And then, so now I have the fourth edition.
There's
so
four editions.
Four editions. And so I looked on Amazon.
Which one's the most valuable, the first edition?
The first one, the one on Amazon.
What about the second Lithuanian edition?
And then the Ukrainian, and now we're into the Belarusian. So the first edition is selling for, yeah. I only have like three or four of them, that is selling for $95.
Well, I've got the first edition. It's in Shqiptar. It's the only known Albanian edition.
Oh, there you go.
But and you just reviewed a book on Solartopia, did you not?
How the biomass hit the wind turbine. Very clever. Jay Warmke, really good writer. It's about, you know, the coming solar age. So it's a Solartopian book, and he's very funny and really interesting. Got a lot of great stuff in the book. How the biomass hit the wind turbine. I like it, and he's got a place out in near Zanesville, I guess, where I'd like to go and see what they're doing out there with renewables and all that stuff.
Well, yeah, he was on a show with me, and he said that he was out there building this totally natural sort of environment in a house, and people kept coming out and looking, so he thought he would charge them to drive them right away. And all he did is create a Solartopian mecca tourist attraction,
which is positive.
Yeah.
Well, he built it out of tires, which I think is pretty cool.
And then one of our friends had trouble with straw bale, and we mentioned it to Jay, and he immediately knew what the problem was.
Really?
And how to do the straw bale thing.
Well, you just, you know, you got to use different crops for your bales. So if you have a house fire, you
the
know,
hemp bale is preferable.
Is, right, if you have a house fire and the fire guys come out, they're just going to lay down and eat stuff and won't put the fire out.
Well, you also read the, or wrote something, was it a book or was it an article on speculation on George Washington and hemp?
Yes, that's my...
And his sexual proclivities.
That's right, that's my book, Passions of the Pot-Smoking Patriots. It's actually the most favorite thing I've ever written. And it portrays George Washington as a gay pot smoker. The book opens when he's about to hop into bed with the Marquis de Lafayette. I mean, I wrote this thing 30 years ago. I still laugh about it. And
as only a historian from the University of Chicago would.
Yeah. We just did a little sketch on it, the first chapter. Washington and Lafayette are smoking pot and they're about to, you know, get it on. And then Daniel Shays breaks in and confronts them with all these issues about the revolution. And so we did a little mini skit at the Starwood Pagan Festival, where we had a woman actually playing the Marquis de Lafayette.
Okay,
and
I can understand.
Washington was a guy.
Just like the Dylan movie.
Yeah. And it was a ton of fun, you know. But so George is portrayed as a gay pot smoker. I have to say, I was on a few radio shows about it, and I was on this one right-wing guy, and we were having a great time discussing who might or might not have been gay. And he took no offense to the idea that George Washington might have been gay, even though it's completely implausible. Not completely. It's pretty implausible. And Lincoln was allegedly gay.
He had advantages if he was bisexual. The T things, they didn't
yeah, exactly.
They didn't obstruct. Hey, in Detroit, that was called customization.
So I'm going through the list of people who may or may not have been gay. And, you know, the speculation about Lincoln and all these other stuff. And then I mentioned J. Edgar Hoover. And he went ballistic, this guy. He said there was no way in the world J. Edgar Hoover was gay.
Mr. Tolson.
Yeah, and he cut me off. He cut off the show. He kicked me off the radio after I dared to say that one of the world's most notorious cross-dressers, J. Edgar Hoover, was, you know, could possibly be gay. Come on.
Well, just because he liked to cross-dress and lived with,
Mr.
Tolson, doesn't mean necessarily
that he was gay. He certainly wasn't very happy. So, and you know, J. Edgar Hoover, since we're chopping, J. Edgar Hoover was actually the godfather of the anti-nuclear movement. I know nobody knows this. It's really a great story. So I can tell you now or after the break, which do you want to do?
Well, let me just say, this is WCRS Community Radio, 98.3 and 102.1, dedicated to finding the sexual proclivities of J. Edgar Hoover.
This is dedicated to the one I love. So, J. Edgar, I was a part of Liberation News Service back in the 1967-68 era. And we were sending out articles. Hippie News Service. We were sending out articles to all the underground papers, right? And we actually were pretty powerful. We had a good following.
Well, because you were fact-based. I hate that.
Yeah. And so the FBI, and this is one of those conspiracy theories we know is true because we've seen the documents from FOIA, which came out in the 70s thanks to a really good journalist.
Freedom of Information Act.
Angus McKenzie, who since passed away, unfortunately, from cancer. So we were infiltrated by J. Edgar's guys as part of COINTELPRO.
And now, you knew this because many were cross-dressers.
And they were carrying crosses. And so their mission was not to inform on us, but to actually break up the news service. They weren't there just playing fun and games.
COINTELPRO.
They wanted the news service
to
end.
This was to essentially destroy things.
Exactly. And so the news service had a terrible split. And the other side, we were the founders, and the other side took to gay baiting Marshall Bloom, who was kind of like the founder of the news service. And so it was got really ugly. And then, wound up, we decided, our group decided, we are the founders, that this wasn't going to work. And in the midst of all this, one of our guys, Steve Diamond, had gotten the Beatles to give us Magical Mystery Tour, this little home movie that they had for a benefit, which we showed at the Fillmore East. You never heard the story?
No, Magical Mystery Tour.
Yeah, yeah. And Stevie had this wonderful experience. He knew Nat Weiss, who I guess was the American agent for the Beatles.
And then the FBI got to the Speckled Oz.
Yeah, yeah. Well, whatever. And so Stevie went into Nat Weiss's office and asked him if we could get Magical Mystery Tour. And Nat Weiss says, well, let's ask George. And he hit the phone and got a speakerphone to England, and George Harrison came on. And Bob, and they asked him, and he said, why, certainly, go ahead. And so we showed it at the Fillmore East, and we raised $5,000 right off the bat in cash. And Marshall and Stevie took that money, and they went up to Western Massachusetts, to Amherst, because Marshall had gone to Amherst College, and he knew the area. And they put a down payment on the farm. We later became the first mortgagees in the history of the Amherst Savings Bank to miss our first four mortgages. We just missed all four payments. But we eventually paid the farm off. So the night of the film showing, which was August 11th, 1968, our group, and it was a Sunday, we went in the morning and we rented a U-Haul and we cleaned it out. And it was perfectly legal because Marshall had incorporated the office, and he and Raymond Mungo and I were three of the four members of the board. And the other
so
one was,
you had a majority of the board.
That's right.
The corporate board.
It was a hostile, leveraged insider takeover is what it was.
And you as part of an unnatural person, a corporate entity.
Yeah, right. Right. We had corporate personhood. So our corporate person went in and ripped off. I mean, it wasn't a ripoff. It was perfectly
legal.
We put everything in the
U-Haul. You weren't ultra-virus. You weren't acting outside your charter.
And we were, I was the last one out. I put Duco cement in the lock. And the office was just clean as a whistle. And then they drove up to the farm in Montague, Massachusetts. And I stayed in New York that night, but I later moved to Montague Farm. So this farm was essentially created because J. Edgar Hoover had tried to destroy our news service. Instead, what happened was, and I love this, you know, our group went up and got a farm. Their group, the other group, stayed in New York and continued the news service. And they were kind of dogmatic for a year or so. They weren't very good, I didn't think, but they were okay. I mean, and then they got more and more hip. And by 1970 or so, they had become not at all unlike the original news service. And so not only did J. Edgar Hoover fail to kill the news service, but there we were suddenly, our group, our drug, sex, and rock and roll contingent, finding ourselves on this farm in western Massachusetts. And we just kind of settled in, and we were burning the furniture to stay warm and all that stuff. We had no idea what we were doing. And then I wrote my History of the United States in the garage, Harvey Wasserman's History of the United States. It was originally called A People's History of the United States, 1860 to 1920. But they Harper and Row thought that was too stiff, especially for a 24-year-old graduate school dropout.
Somewhere I have a copy of the original where you're on a tractor, right?
Yeah,
with really long hair.
Right. I have the original manuscript, actually, written, typed on a 1927 Underwood black upright typewriter, which I loved. And so, that's the situation. All these publishers were turning it down, saying, never send us anything again. But I sent it to Howard Zinn, and he wrote me a nice letter, which I still have. I have that letter. And then Harper asked him to write the intro. They said, if Howard Zinn will write an intro, we think your book is total crap. They said that to me. But if Howard will write the intro, we'll take a chance. So he did, and it sold 30,000 copies. And then, of course, they came to him, and he wrote The People's History of the United States. So I've always been really glad about that. I mean, every time I see one, as you say in Detroit, I kvell. So let me go. So then I'll just finish the story, because I'll forget about J. Edgar Hoover, and we'll finish the hour, and I won't remember. So then in 1973... Right? The mm-hmm. utility comes in. And here we are. By 1973, we knew what we were doing. We had an organic garden. The house was insulated. I mean, we were writing books and having a great old time. And, all the stuff that you hear about going on those hippie farms, it happened, We were keeping the Quail Company in business. And so I always like to see who laughs at that. Okay, so then at the end of 1973, the utility company says, well, we're going to build a nuclear plant in Montague. 4 miles from our house. And we looked at him and we said, no, you're not. And I coined the phrase, no nukes, and the rest is history. So that's how J. Edgar Hoover became the godfather of the anti-nuclear movement, because we never would have got to that farm if he hadn't tried to destroy it with COINTELPRO.
So he contributed but wasn't original on cross-dressing. Pretty much the godfather of the anti-nuke movement.
Absolutely.
And to some extent, the modern organic farming movement.
Yeah, well, we were written up, actually, Rob Rodale. The one decision we made, and we never had any meetings. We were totally just hippos, But we'd sit around and shoot the shit at, can we say that on the radio? At dinner. We never had a meeting to decide whether or not we were going to use chemicals on this farm. We just kind of didn't, And suddenly we said, well, we'll be an organic farm. And then Rob Rodale from the Organic Gardening and Farming magazine showed up and he visited and took a picture and the whole deal. And so, we were for our generation, for the baby boomers, we were among the very first organic farms.
A long tradition on the left, of course, going back to the great Scott Nearing.
Oh, God, I met Scott Nearing. He was an amazing guy. Yeah, up in Maine. And he was really a cool guy. And what was this called? Simple something. I can't remember the book he wrote.
Including We Build a Stone House, one of my favorite chapters.
Or We Stoned Build a House. That's what we did. So
Scott Nearing.
Yeah, he was an amazing guy. And also very important in Ohio was Lewis Bromfield, who lived in Mansfield and who started Malabar Farm.
Farms, sure.
And which is now a state park. It's a beautiful state park, really worth going to. And here's a quick quiz. Who of our listeners do you know who was married at Malabar Farm?
Let's see. Who was married? Hollywood.
Hollywood.
Yes.
Big time.
Humphrey Bogart.
And? Who did he marry?
He married...
Rock Hudson. No, sorry. Lauren Bacall.
I don't know.
Lauren Bacall.
Lauren Bacall.
And she was like 12 at the time. So it was like, a big deal. So, they were married under the steps of of Malabar Farm, and founded by Louis Bromfield. Great socialist. They don't tell you that when you're there, by the way. Well, but at any rate, so J. Edgar Hoover, I hope you're spinning in your grave in your party dress.
But you're dressed... in a feathered boa.
Yeah, so I interrupted you, Bob. What were you going to say?
No, I forgot what I was going to say.
Well, see, I didn't want to forget.
But the key thing, was, of course, as we wind down, is you're connected to many of the well-known lefties. And I mean, I went over to your house one time, and who's drinking a long-neck beer on the couch?
Molly, I was kind of
and her. You talked her into playing basketball with us.
So she was better than we were.
I know, she was taller.
She had a really power center there.
She had really sharp elbows.
Yeah, and a good jump shot.
Yeah,
boy, I miss Molly Ivins. She was Molly. We love you. We miss you. Where
and,
are you now?
And we as we fade out here and go to Solartopia, the other, the one time you got me to speak, and Jackson Brown and of course Bonnie, you know, invited me on the bus there with it. You got to go with him.
Yeah,
I had to teach.
Oh.
That's the problem of having a tenure track.
Well, at any rate. It's been a ton of fun, and here we are entering geezerhood.
Which is the key thing, and Norman Thomas said that, is that what people don't emphasize is how much fun it is
to be
a radical agitator in the U.S.
Absolutely.
We're out here. This is Bob Trakas with the Other Side of the News, WCRS 98.3, 102.1. Thanks, Harvey.
My pleasure.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Did we evolve from Ethan Smith? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
So now we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.
Garden was lost, so we had to work to pay the cost. So we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world.
The rich got rich, the poor guys served. The fuel they spent, the price jumped high. Conservative nuclear power drive.
Oh, don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over the God's green world.
But the nuclear plants built in haste, with too many risks and no place for waste. It's sold from Seabrook to Shoreham Town. We
Don't you know?